Before we kick off this episode of Current Geek, it is incumbent upon me to remind you that we are brought to you by you through your efforts over at frogpants.cratejoy.com. It's not much of an effort. You just decide if you want this thing or not. You guys know all about these crate services, these box services. They send you cool, nerdy stuff every month. Why not do one that supports us here at Current Geek? It is how we peep. It's how we keep the lights on. It's how we pay the bills. Pay and keep. It made peep. Anyway, that's a fantastic way to do it. There's art from me, writing from Tom, stickers, badges, cool stuff from our guests, all kinds of great stuff. Shot glasses we had one month. We got done with a calendar here shortly ago, a custom calendar with artwork from me and a future prediction from Tom. All kinds of cool stuff. We predict future little gavels in there. So if you're a fan of Current Geek, show it by going to frogpants.cratejoy.com. And you know what? Do it today.
I have Current Geek!
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars. Geeks of the world and you to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson with Tom Merritt. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Scott Johnson. I have my Current Geek shot glass from the Current Geek Crate Joy, and I am ready to take a shot every time Terry O'Quinn's name is mentioned
on
today's show.
My expectations are high for the frequency of Terry O'Quinn's name being evoked here on the show, because we have guests with us, and we'll start with the guest who may say it here and there. It's Joel Robertson, host of the Retro Movie Geeks podcast. Welcome to the show, man.
Terry O'Quinn.
Oh, dude.
Yes, thank you, guys. It is an honor to be here.
Tom,
this is fantastic.
Tom, you're going to be sauced by the time.
I'm going to make sure.
I'm fine, Scott.
Have 911 queued up. There may be alcohol poisoning.
Oh, man.
But it doesn't have to be alcoholic. Everyone can join in with whatever beverage they wish.
But you will probably have to go to the bathroom before the end of the show, no matter what.
We'll all be taking pee breaks.
Exactly. Yeah. That other voice you hear is our other guest, my neighbor, I guess, of sorts. He lives in Ogden, which isn't too far from where I live.
Welcome
in Salt Lake City.
Terry O'Quinn.
Yeah, it's Terry O'Quinn, everybody.
Yeah.
Hasn't aged a minute. It's Russ Adams, special effects shop owner in Ogden called Escaped Design FX. You can go to their website, escapedesignfx.com. I can't wait to learn more about that. Welcome to the show, Russ.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Really good to have you here, man.
You're making him drink a little more. What was it again?
Terry O'Quinn.
Yeah. That's right. By the way, you're gonna from here on out be the you're the Jamie Hyneman of Utah. How's that? You like that?
Wait. Okay, no, Jamie. Okay. If you said Adam, we would have
which one? Okay, Jamie.
Oh yeah, Jamie. Okay, that's fine. Yeah. Well, it's good to have you both here. We got tons to talk about, as we always do, and we'll start with these here top stories.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Tom?
If you see people walking around like this, it might not just be texting that they're holding their phones in front of their face. It might be Pokemon Go, which launched Wednesday, sending people out in the real world in order to collect Pokemon in an augmented reality game that actually borrows some of its locations from Ingress because it's made by Niantic. Turns out the police station in Darwin, Australia was a popular location. On its official Facebook account, the Northern Territory Police, Fire, and Emergency Services wrote that Pokemon Go players did not need to enter the station to collect their Pokeballs, and that, quote, "It's also a good idea to look up, away from your phone, and both ways before crossing the street. That sand shrew isn't going anywhere fast. Stay safe and catch them all." And it's probably a good idea to look around, because 19-year-old Shayla Wiggins of Riverton, Wyoming, discovered a deceased man floating in the Wind River while attempting to catch a Pokemon from a natural water source at 8:30 a.m. Friday morning. Police believe the death was accidental.
Oh, my gosh. All right. I hadn't heard about the Wyoming thing, by the way. But leading up to this, I've been very, very excited about Pokemon Go. Not even a big Pokemon player or care that much about the Pokemon, as it were. But this morning, I have a great little story. I was out jogging with the dog. It's a nice hot day here in Salt Lake City, running around the park. And I noticed two kids who are walking very slowly with phones in front of them. And they're both wearing backpacks and red baseball hats and like shoes. They all look like Ash from the Pokemon series. and they were out looking for Pokemon, I assumed. So as I jogged by, pulled my earbuds out, and I said, "You guys playing Pokemon Go?" And they went, "Yeah." And I said, "That's so awesome." They're like, "Yeah, it's totally awesome. We just caught like three back here." So they're completely freaking out. Obviously, we are on the heels of a huge, momentous, moment in app usage. People are really into this thing. Joel, any interest at all in Pokemon at your age?
Not really. It sort of passed me by. You know, I turned 40 in January, so I wasn't quite in the Pokemon craze. I do have a question. Do Pokeballs itch?
No.
Okay.
No, but and they gather.
You need to itch your Pokeballs.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they get they gather no moss. That's an important thing to mention.
Yeah. The other question I had was, did anybody else find it just a little ironic that the Darwin police station is where they had to warn people to look up from their phone to say, I'm just going to argue natural selection, but
right. they did not name the awards after the police station, but it is ironic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Russ, how do you feel about this idea that at any given time, there might be four or five of these little Pokemon around you and you're supposed to find them?
You know what? Let's just hope my dogs don't find them first.
Well,
and I always thought Pokemon was like some kind of Asian porn. I didn't realize.
That's when it's spelled as two words instead of one. That's
exactly.
Pokemon. I get you now. Okay.
So here's this is the funny thing about it. Like, I'm not anywhere near the age group. I think none of us probably are as the intended target anyway. But I went ahead and gave this thing a spin.
Same
and
here.
It's kind of ridiculously addicting and weirdly exercise inducing and kind of hard to stop doing. So let me just put this out here for other adults who may understand. If you are into something like geocaching, this is basically that, with a few twists and obviously a brand that's recognizable and a big hook for kids. But really, that's what you're doing. And you're doing it in a way that's very visual. You open up your map and you're looking at a representation of your little avatar walking around in your neighborhood. Like, the streets are all cut the way they're supposed to be. It's like Google Maps or whatever. The ingress data is actual satellite data, street data, map data. And you walk around with this thing and you see where the Pokemon are and you walk over to them. And when you battle them, you don't actually fight them, but you capture them. And you do that by flicking a Pokeball at them. And you hope you don't miss. And they're kind of in the world, like augmented reality. So you're looking through your camera. And if you move, it stays in its place and sort of, you know, is kind of in the world in a way. And there's something about it, Tom. I don't know what it is, but something about it is super compelling and maybe kind of Ingress-like, actually, with a few, you know, a few twists that are a little more Pokemon related. But what has your experience been like?
I'm 46 years old, never was into Pokemon. I was like, you know what? Augmented reality. I'm going to try it out. So I'm in a lift. We're taking a lift to a trivia night on Wednesday night. And I open up the game. I just got in right before we got in the car. So I had just installed the app and I go through all the setup and I see all these Pokemon stops, all these Pokestops off the highway, right? We're on the interstate. Yeah. We're on the freeway.
Yeah.
Or we, as we call it, the 405 out here.
Yeah.
And I see, I'm like, well, I can't do this in the car. This is crazy. And suddenly there's one that shows up in the car. So it's, I get to the view where you see it in the real world and it's just sitting on the windowsill in the back seat. So I, you know, throw my Pokeball at it. I capture it. And I was like, that was amazing. There was one actually in the car with me. That was really cool.
Yeah.
That has not happened since. And all the Pokemon on my map show up at least two or three blocks away from me now. So I haven't caught another one yet because I can't be bothered to go out and find them. I've got too much to do. And that's when the old man takes over and I can't play it anymore.
Yeah, no, there's a point. And they've had service problems, I should mention.
I have had a hard time getting in from time to time, too. Yeah. That's true.
Gee, I wonder if they should beef up servers for a game that is clearly aimed at a ton of children during the summer when they're not in school. Like,
let me tell you, no system administrator has ever said, no, I don't think we have enough servers at launch. Like, they thought they did. It just, they did estimated wrong.
I guess so. Well, whatever. It's success that they are surely enjoying at this point. And may it ever rain as the weirdest thing that people are doing this week with their phones.
Blizzard has filed a lawsuit in California against Bossland GmbH, a company that makes Watch Over Tyrant, a program that gives Overwatch players
advantages. Some people call them cheats, things like knowing where all the opposing players are, even when you can't see them, aiming assistance. Blizzard claims unfair competition, violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act circumvention provision, and some other copyright violations. And the thing is, Blizzard has gone up against Bossland before and lost over software that aided players of Heroes of the Storm.
Joel, are you a competitive gamer at all?
I have not played regularly since before my first child was born, because I have three young boys now and it just doesn't happen anymore.
Gotcha.
So I'm probably not the best to discuss this. I guess I read through the article, and I'm a complete layman. Let's go at it from that perspective. I would love to know, do you guys perceive this as something that is, I don't know. When I read it, I thought, okay, well, is it the equivalent of cheat codes? Like back in the Nintendo days, like is it really something that,
well, as
cost
a,
them millions.
As a okay, so that's a really interesting question, and perhaps therein lies the rub. So I'm an active Overwatch player. I love the game. I've loved it since Alpha. I've been playing it since then and really, really like it in its current form. They just introduced a competitive mode, which is designed to be, you know, a mode that you rank up through. It's very serious and try hard. Everybody wants to do really well in there. It's very frustrating when you lose. You're trying to compete with the world for the best score. And so when you have games like that, people tend to take that pretty seriously. It's, a bit like real sports in a sense. And so the idea that people can cheat and see where you are and see what your health levels are is a huge detriment to you in the game. Does this lawsuit represent Blizzard's attempt to not lose millions of dollars? I don't think so. The players that it affects are the ones that are loving it and are in. And we fully expect Blizzard to stop cheating, to anytime this sort of thing happens, to stand up and say, nope, that's not going to happen, and make ways for the game not to support this sort of thing, like they do with all of their games. None of that is really an issue or a question. So I'm not sure where this money is that they think they would lose exactly. And I am no expert. I am zero lawyer man, nothing to do with any of that stuff. I'm terrible at that stuff, but I don't understand the damages part, because the players themselves aren't paying a subscription. They buy the game, they buy it once, and then they play it for as much or as little as they want to, and it's as simple as that. So I don't actually know why the damages are so high, and maybe that's just where you start and you work your way down and you settle. I don't know. Tom, any additional?
Yeah, and the BBC story does not mention the DMCA element of this, which I find reprehensible. Don't use the DMCA to punish someone for something else. But I suppose they can say, well, they're using our intellectual property to promote their game, whatever. What is more understandable is them saying this is a violation of contract. You have terms of service that say if you're going to access this game, you can't do these things. This software is allowing people to do these things, so they are violating the contract by accessing the game against our rules. And so it's a civil case. It's not there's no crime happening here. It's a breach of contract case. And I guess what Blizzard's saying is, well, if somebody goes to play Overwatch and then they get toasted because somebody else is using the cheat, they'll say that's not a fun game to play. Then maybe they won't buy it if they're playing somebody else's, or maybe they'll dissuade other people from buying it, and then it's lost sales.
Thoughts, Russ?
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking it's probably just lost sales because people get sick and tired of dealing with that. If it's another game that all of a sudden we've got people bouncing around, bulletproof, all kinds of different things, then they're going to stop buying that game and look for something else that's a little more legit. I've never actually played it. When I was playing, which wasn't even that long ago, it was Battlefield 2. Oh, and yeah. I hated the upgrade. That Battlefield 3 sucked. Battlefield 4 sucked. You know, it was always Battlefield 2. There was always some jackass in I'm sorry. You might want to edit that out. There was always somebody in there who you could you could shoot 35 times. He wasn't going down. And you know that he was using some kind of, you know, cheat. And to be able to snipe you like that, you know, he was using an auto aim or something, and it just ruins the fun of the game. However, you know, you're playing these games and you're on the other side of the map and somebody kills you with a shotgun from like what's probably like half a mile. Not so, you know, legitimate there either. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
They got 10 outstanding cases against Bossland. So this is kind of personal at this point, because my inclination is to say, I wish they would just go for software blocks to say, well, if we catch you using this, we're going to ban your account, or we have changed the code so that their software doesn't work anymore. And I'm sure Blizzard is doing that, but they're obviously frustrated because GmbH Bossland is apparently really good at this and able to get around all of the defenses they can come up with. So they're just going for the legal option.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say,
there's a loss of labor, you know, the cost of labor changing all those codes and everything else, you know, having to put somebody in there to block codes and to keep updating things that maybe didn't necessarily need it. I mean, people, when they're playing and stuff, they think that it's a finished product, you know, that game is a finished product, but it's constantly being updated. And the more labor you have to add to it, the more that game's going to cost in the future, the more the company's going
to
lose.
That's true. It's difficult to gauge those amounts too. Like, we don't really know what that impact is. And we know there are already people constantly at that company and others at developers where you're always seeing updates. They're always looking for holes. They're looking for bugs. They're looking for problems, exploits, and so on. So none of this is new. What's new about this actual case is the ferocity at which Blizzard is going after them. That's the part that's different, because really since the dawn of, I don't know, the first Quake Arena game I played back in 1998, those days were also rife with cheaters. Like, as long as we've had competitive online games, there have been people trying to game the system and mess with things. Counter-Strike has been no stranger to this. I could name a million games. So, you know, the fact that this is happening at all isn't the surprise. To me, the surprise is how hard they're going, and maybe that's a good thing.
I don't know, man. I want to be bulletproof. I need some aim assist.
See, and for me, it takes the fun out of it. It's like, you know, if you're hopping around out there and no one can kill you and you're hitting everybody, all the fun's been taken out of it. So why cheat? Yeah.
You guys heard it here first. Tom needs aim assist. Oh, and by the way, if you play Soldier 76, his ultimate is an aim assist ultimate. So there you go. He's your man.
There you go. It's already built in. Yep. Oh, that's what Blizzard should do. They should just make a mod that gives you all of these things for free, but then sticks you in a separate arena where you're only playing against other people who also have them. And then there's no reason to give Bossland any money.
Sure. Yeah, why not? That's true. Sounds like
Unreal Tournament was a good one. Did you guys ever play that?
Oh, heck yeah,
like,
dude.
Offline, they had these rooms that were gigantic. You could play in this giant bathroom and you were like this big on the tiles of the floor. It was fantastic.
Oh, yeah. No, listen, Unreal, and there's a new version of Unreal right now that's killing it, looking real good. It's not out of beta yet, but Unreal is one of the finest shooter experiences I ever had, and yet that thing was like Swiss cheese with the cheats. People cheated. So, yeah, everyone, no one's immune. We're all soldiers now, as Soldier 76
saying
would
it was
say.
Swiss cheats?
Swiss cheats. There you go. Nicely said, Tom.
James Newman has built an enormous computer. It is 10 meters wide, 2 meters high, contains 40,000 transistors, 10,000 LEDs. It weighs 500 kilograms. He spent 4 years and 40,000 pounds building it. And it's a 16-bit computer with 256 bytes. Not kilobytes, not megabytes, bytes. 256 bytes of RAM and a 20 kilohertz processor. As the astute among you already noticed, it uses transistor, so no silicon. Newman built the computer to visualize how a microprocessor works, and he hopes it can be used maybe at a museum or an educational institute. Right now, he uses it to play Tetris.
I'm a little surprised it costs.
How many vacuum tubes?
Yeah, that's the thing. Is this feels like it's an attempt to create an earlier way of computing. These giant IBM mainframes come to mind, and you know, computers that would fill an entire room and be full of tubes and weird smoke and having to, you know, deal with it in a very different way than we do today. But it seems like his point is way more educational. I'm just surprised how much it cost. How come this wasn't cheaper?
A lot of transistors and blinky lights. He has a lot of blinky lights too.
All right. Pay for those blinky lights. Yeah. Joel, you want one of these? You want to buy the next one that's available?
I was just going to say, does this automatically make him king of the hipsters? to have
done it? Maybe. I mean, it is the most retro thing I've read about today.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, but just so we're clear here, I'm the goon that's interested in the Kodak Super 8 film digital camera thing that's coming out. So I have no room to talk. I'm just saying there's a part of me that's super impressed. And then a part of me of wondering, wow, the money, the time, that is, it's tremendous. I mean,
well, it's 40,000 transistors, 40,000 pounds. That's a pound per transistor.
Okay, there you go.
What is a pound worth right now? Like 10 cents?
Something like that.
Yeah. Like a nickel. Yeah.
Sorry, Britain. Y'all voted for it. We're just reporting it. Anyway, what Tom you're gonna say?
No, it's it. I kind of get it. I kind of get the idea of like, oh, I want to see how a processor works. And if I build an integrated circuit, it's too small for me to see. But a transistor is something I could see and diagram it out so that you can know, like, that's the L2 cache right there. That's where the instruction sets are being processed with the blinky lights right there. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. I think you could have maybe done this, you know, like one of the more famous examples is somebody, I don't remember his name, but he basically built a functioning computer within Minecraft. So all of the way he arranged blocks and circuits and IO was all done with these physical in-game objects, but it made a computer and it worked in the way that it's supposed to. And kids could walk through there and they could see where things had to connect and how it all worked together. And it kind of worked in slow motion. So not only did you get to see sort of structurally what a computer is and what a chip does, but you got to see it happen in a much slower way. So it wasn't just lightning fast data. You could see the way that things would move and how bytes would get from one place to another and the way storage worked and that sort of thing. It just seems cheaper, though, than 40,000 pounds.
But you can't walk around inside of it.
It's a good point. And I see the value in this. Like, this is not me poo-pooing this. I think this is super, super cool. But
don't poo-poo inside of the transistors here. It's not safe.
But I just feel like we are entering a phase with VR specifically where we can create anything we want to create and create a pretty reasonable facsimile of very scientific, interesting things that involve physics and other things. So why not that? It feels a little bit like the effects world, Russ. You can make almost anything seem real now.
Well, we hope. that's where the paychecks come in. But... you know, you definitely want to beat the CG guys to it. You know, I don't know. It seems cool at the same time, you know, to see a computer that big. And, you know, I mean, just the idea of it is pretty interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. I would like to actually check that out. Like, is there photos or anything? Did anybody post any any photos?
Yeah, in the article, there's a shot of it. Yeah, kind of an overhead three-quarter view. And then there's some video of him talking. What's interesting to me again is just the cost. Like, to me, it just seems cost prohibitive. And maybe if you've got enough passion for this sort of thing, then go for it. People do a lot weirder things with cars.
There are things in my shop that are cost prohibitive.
I was going to ask. Yeah. Especially like you guys are focused, but we're going to talk about it more later, but you guys focus on so much practical stuff. That's what gets expensive. Like, people want to think the expense and effects these days are big rendering farms and computers and animators and all that stuff. And while none of that's very cheap, what seems very expensive is creating scale model cities and, you know, big rubber.
It's the reverse. It used to be that way. And that's why everybody kind of went to the CG side. It was like, oh, it's cheaper. Let's just do that. But in reality, the pendulum swung the other direction. And now it's, you know, cheaper to do the practical than it is to do the CG. Maybe the CG guys just got a little too big for their britches. I don't know. You know, that
well,
was...
I mean, there's a huge dispute of whether visual effects people are paid enough right now, but there are so many of them.
Yes.
I mean, if you've sat ever through the credits of any movie, you know, like it's like 17 different effects houses and at least 30 names, if not 100 names or more up there. So even if you're not paying them very well, which apparently they're not, that cost adds up. I can see where suddenly it's like, wow, to get a realistic visual effect actually is costly right now compared to do. I mean, how many people does it take to make a scene for a movie for practical effects?
Oh, for a practical, it just depends. Like, we have, like in my case, you know, they want a werewolf. Well, with the CG guys, you have to have a guy who's doing the hair. And sometimes, like, I think we were talking to Brave, the little girl in Brave. It was like 3 years to get her hair to do what they wanted it to do. And that was just her hair, you know? How much time and effort was spent in there when they could have just handed, I don't know, like us a wig, you know? And, you know, we would have made it, you know, move, right, with fans and things like that. But I would say, like, for me to build a werewolf costume, even if it was like bare bones, no animatronics, we're talking like $6,500, between $65,000 and maybe $12,000, you know? It's not nearly as much. And then you've got the actor who wears it and things like that. Plus there's no glitches. There's no recomputing something. If you have something on the fly, you want the guy to turn a certain way. You don't have to go to a bank of people, you know, to have this creature turn. Cause then the hair has to move a certain way. The lighting guy has to move a certain way.
Well, do you need 30 people to make the suit?
No, me. That's it. Are you kidding? I'm a small shop owner, man, and I'm Scottish, so I'm a cheap son of a bitch.
Hey, I'm Scottish too.
You know, see, we all stick together. Yeah, I got a couple of cents in my pocket now, but no, I make this stuff myself. So it's one guy build it. You maybe have maybe two guys on set, maybe three, you know, helping the guy in the suit. And then that's really kind of it. I mean, sometimes you can up it a little bit to make, you know, obviously the more, you know, the more imaginative they want to get with the creature, you might need a couple other people, maybe somebody running the radio controls and stuff. But when it comes to, you know, practical effects, it's like a fraction of the manpower. And it's just really, it's amazing to see how much money they spend on CG nowadays. Well, when, you know, like even Star Wars, like the latest Star Wars, there's some things you can't get away with.
But is it like this? Like I always think of this when there's a, I love this kind of stuff. So I apologize if I'm talking too much about it, but
keep going.
The idea of like an old, well, not an old movie. Let's say there's a movie made in 1965. It costs whatever it costs to make, and it's set in that time and you're done. There's your movie. 10 years goes by. You want to make a movie about an event that happened in 1965. The cost to make everything look like 65 again, even though you're only a decade out, is, you know, it's a nominal amount of money to make that quote unquote period piece of 10 years ago come to life the way you want it to. Jump to the 70s, 80s, 90s, or even now in 2016, if I want to make a movie about 1965 now, it is orders of magnitude more expensive now to make it look like the 60s than it would have been had we made it in the 60s, even adjusted for inflation. I would think that effects and practical and CGI would have the same kind of weird divergence. As it gets less and less expensive and more tools are available to more and more people to make stuff look good, you know, in CG and with computer-aided design, that would become cheaper, cheaper, cheaper. And the further we get away from the heyday of practical mm-hmm. effects are just going to get more and more expensive and less the option. Am I right in any of that thinking?
It does get less and less expensive. And I think, you know, and even the time frames are even less. I mean, when we're talking about the 60s, if you're doing a period piece, there's things that you're never going to get away from. Those costumes are definitely one of them. Because, I mean, now you've got a diverse amount of costumes that you need and different sizes and things like that. You know, and then what do you do with them when you're done? You stick them in a closet and then you don't try to resell them or whatever. In that particular respect, it does get a little, a little pricey. But when we're talking about something like, I'm a creature guy, so of course I'm going to revert to creature. You know, if you wanted a creature on the fly, you would call somebody like me. Like, for instance, we just did a commercial for the Colorado Wildlife Foundation. They gave me 2 weeks to create a full, you know, size deer and a smaller puppeted version that we could do for the camera. 2 weeks, man. And it was like, you know, I mean, you can't even pull that off with CG. You can't create something like that, you know, in that amount of time. So, and it was really inexpensive. I think they got lucky. I was in a good mood that day. And I think it was only like $12,000 I charged them for the entire thing. So,
wow, that's cheap.
Did you hire a deer?
No.
A trained deer.
Okay. That was okay. It too. It was completely upholstery foam. The thing that took the longest about building that thing was, and it's up on my website. It took the longest was getting the materials in. You know, vendors taking forever. I mean, that was the hard part. But I mean,
were you picketed by deers who were like, "You're taking our job"?
I got into some trouble when it came to loading it into the back of my car. There were some people. Hey, man, it ain't deer season. You know, it's
that's a compliment. You're like,
thank you. Yes, it's not, but that shows that I did my job.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, and you and I live in a state where deer season is beloved, so I'm not surprised you'd get comments.
You can't be shooting that thing out of season.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, do you guys think that, because I think this ties in with Russ and what he does and this guy building the computer, there is something of the maker in us as humans, the tactile, the aesthetic of wanting something that's actually there and coming at it as a fan, because you know, I have my show, we focus on retro stuff, and I'm a practical effects guy. I'm cool with CGI when it is done well, and when I don't feel like I'm just, you know, watching something that's animated, unless in fact it is an animated film, you know, but I go with Force Awakens. I think there was a really cool blend of both that I feel like that was one of the things that Abrams got, was that idea of the, you know, especially the creatures, you know, blending it. And I think that they, I'm trying to think of how I want to say it. It was just the aesthetic of seeing things that were tangibly there that the characters were interacting with. No Jar Jar Binks, you know, everything was such that, I don't know, it just, it really felt more connected. The whole world just felt more real to me. So I guess that's where I'm going with it, is that I feel like maybe the guy built the computer, because there is something about just building with your hands, you know, just putting the work in and building this thing.
Oh, yeah. And fans appreciated it. I mean, Tom, how often did we hear that, how excited everybody was that so much of Force Awakens and beyond were going to be practical effects?
Yeah. Now I find out they were just cheaping out because it's cheaper.
And it still costs, what, $150? Another $150 million?
Yeah, something like that.
All right, let's get into a couple more stories before we're done here. Ash vs. Evil Dead Season 2 trailer is out from Starz. The series returns in October, and if that isn't enough of Sam Raimi's creation in your life, Space Goat Productions has opened up its Kickstarter for Evil Dead 2, the board game, where 2 to 6 players can work together in 60 to 90 minute sessions to gather pages of the Ex Mortis while trying to survive demon attacks, supernatural events, and avoid turning into deadites themselves.
So we have a film nerd on the show, and we have a guy who makes special effects and probably has a huge love for this series. So Russ, you're probably a giant Evil Dead fan, I'm guessing. Oh, did we lose
Russ dropped out, Scott.
Yes, I heard Skype go bloop.
Oh, is that what happened there? Okay, we'll re-add him.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Joel. Joel, you like a movie full of Ash and his Evil Dead, right?
You bet. And I love that series, too. So we'll go back to that. But Evil Dead 2, quick side story, 13 years old, Halloween night, HBO has a triple feature. Pumpkinhead, Evil Dead 2, and I don't remember for the life of me what the third film was. And Evil Dead 2 had this immense impression on me as a youngster, and I shortly thereafter, it was in 92 that we got Army of Darkness
was 91 or 92.
I want to say 93 because I remember being in Austin.
Right,
so it's around that era. So I went and saw that in the theater. Another quick side story, I lost a potential girlfriend over it because we went on our first date and we worked together, and her immediate response after the movie was over was, boy, was that dumb.
No, you're right, 92.
I was like, we're done. So, because I'm sorry, you can't knock Army of Darkness. But Evil Dead, I've never been a huge fan of Evil Dead. I like it. I appreciate it. But I was so into Evil Dead 2 and I believe Bruce Campbell calls it Splatstick. Mm. And I like that humorous tone. And then as a kid, I go and I watch Evil Dead. I'm like, whoa, you know, totally different movie. Yes, tonally. But Evil Dead 2, I have a soft spot in my heart, and I'm actually excited for this game. I'm not a big board game kind of guy. My wife is. I don't know that she'll be down for this. Yeah. But it looks great. I mean, I love that for, I guess, an extra $20, if you're willing to put it in, you can get extra things like the Book of the Dead cover and an extended neck Henrietta.
Oh, good, because she's one of my favorite things in that
Swallow Your Soul
second movie thing. Yeah, she was gross.
Swallow this.
I mean,
yeah, that's right.
So I don't have any particular affinity for the Evil Dead movies. I have a real strong love for Army of Darkness as well. But yeah,
I 92. Yeah. I should never have doubted you, Joel.
Okay, that's all right. I forgive you, Tom.
But yeah, I always preferred Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 to Army of Darkness. I don't know why.
Mm.
I think maybe because I loved them first.
Did you see Evil Dead first?
Yeah. No, I had seen Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 before Army of Darkness came out.
And I think that's I've noticed that pattern. It seems like with people, if they start with Army of Darkness, then, I can't say to everybody, but most people that I've talked to like that the most, obviously. But even Evil Dead 2, I feel like that one, because I think it sets you up for a certain tone that carries over to Army of Darkness. While Army of Darkness is not as nearly as intense as the first two, but Evil Dead, when you go back and watch it, some of the effects surely don't hold up, but just the tone and the tree sexual assault, I mean, there's so many things in that movie that are so disturbing that when you go into Evil Dead 2 and it's so over the top, but it's funny and it's, I don't know, I really love the film, and I just feel like it'll be, from what I'm looking at on this board game, they do capture a lot of the elements. And if you watch the little promo video they have, it's actually pretty funny, because I think they say, play any one of your favorite characters, and also Nick, which is the little hillbilly guy. So it's great. I think it's going to be cool.
You can play as Nick. That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, the only final thing I would say is I have not seen the new show, and I hear it's really great, and I probably should watch
awesome.
It. It's awesome. Yeah.
It's awesome.
There you go.
Now, in celebration of the 30th anniversary of Aliens, many of the cast and crew will reunite on July 23rd at Comic-Con. That will include director James Cameron, producer Gail Ann Hurd, Sigourney Weaver, Bill Paxton, Lance Henriksen, Paul Reiser, Michael Biehn, Kerry Henn, all going to be on a panel today or together on July 23rd. I think they should invite the Xenomorph as well. An Aliens 30th anniversary Blu-ray and digital HD release is also planned for September 13th.
Anything, I mean, are we going to hear anything from what's his name? Why is my brain gone blank on the director?
Russ?
James Cameron, James the Cameron. One I just said.
Did you say James Cameron? Oh, you did at the top there.
Down to the dock.
Oh, okay. I missed it. Yeah. No, that's exciting. I always felt like that was like one of his most important movies. I know Terminator's a big deal, and Terminator 2 was an even bigger deal. And, you know, like him going from his sort of Gorman beginnings and kind of, you know, cheap crap B movie level start, and then moving into this new place because of those movies is a big deal for him. But I always felt like Aliens was the most important for me anyway. Maybe it just hit at the right time. It was 1986. I was in high school. I was super into that movie. Probably at the time would have said out loud it was my favorite movie of all time. Not so sure over time if it is, but man, it's such a big deal. And so to hear that he's involved is exciting for me, because I always got the impression he wanted to quickly move on to do something else. And maybe it's because he didn't come back for 3 or something. And I just had it in my head that he was just done and wanted to wash his hands of it, but maybe not. So this is exciting. It's very cool. 30 years, man. Can you believe that? 30 freaking years since we've all been saying game over, man, game over.
Well, and it's funny to me because Aliens, remember, this is number 2, right? This is not the first one, is often considered to be the one to watch. I took a film class in college, I remember, and they showed us Aliens. They said, you can go back and watch Alien 2. It's good. But Aliens is the one we watch. And yet we all consider James Cameron to be the guy who likes to make movies that blow things up. Mm-hmm. And granted, there's blowing up going on in Aliens, but it is a critically acclaimed movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, for sure. It's just great. And then there's a scene, I don't want to spoil anything, but there is a scene in this recent season of Game of Thrones, season 6, that happens inside of a, let's call it a cave tree. That's as far as I'm going to give any hints at. But there's a moment in there that if you've seen Aliens, then you've seen this scene. And you've seen Vasquez do something with a grenade. And that's all I'm going to say about it. I'm just saying, I think that the guys over at the Game of Thrones show are using that as their inspiration. That's all I'm saying.
They're paying homage.
Yeah, there you go. Well said.
I mean, you must take a lot of inspiration, Russ, from Aliens or even Alien, right?
On a lot of levels, like even the mechs in the background, you know, the sets, everything was completely just mesmerizing. I've got my phone on an ice pack right now. I'm sorry, guys. It's overheated. I was like,
I admire that. That's awesome.
That's super cool. Yeah.
Thanks for persevering.
Yeah. Sticking with it. So have you had to build a Xenomorph or anything quite that big in scale?
No, actually, so many people have done it that I just sort of just never even gave it a shot. I mean, I've done things like, you know, Predators and stuff, but so many people have done, you know, the Aliens that it just seems like it's been overdone. And so I never really wanted to throw my hat in there. But
well, while we've got you talking, let's talk real quick about what it is that happens over there in your special effects shop. You've kind of mentioned that, hey, you're kind of a one man guy in terms of, you know, you're building most of the stuff, you're working with vendors and things. But I'm really curious how the process works. Let's say I'm making a movie and it's, I don't know, we'll use werewolves again. I'm making a werewolf movie and I'm filming it in Tooele and I need a creature suit real bad. How does that work? What do I do?
Well, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to tell me how great you want it to look. And then you're going to tell me you got $500. That's how it's going to start.
Oh, it's so true.
You laugh, but that's how it starts. Yeah. And so I have to burst your bubble. But essentially, you know, it depends on the production. We could do anything from a maquette. We'll do like a small sculpture to show them, you know, the concept, or we'll do some stuff in Photoshop to try to kind of like get the idea out so we're all on the same page. You know, we just finished. It was last spring, not this past spring, the spring before. We were doing a project called Screamers that I was lucky enough to actually even get an associate producer credit on. And that one was they were creating it was like the skin. It was like they kept describing it as as a skin, but burlap. So this guy had been rotting in this burlap mask for so long that it actually become part of his skin. So I got to sculpt that. And so we came up with so many different versions, and it was like 2 weeks later, you know, we had cut the concept down. We sculpted it. And I'm showing them pictures. Is this approved? Yes, it's approved. We can go to the next step. Start the next step. Hey, listen, you know, we've got the mold. Everything's good to go, right? I start mixing the silicone, which cannot be reversed, and I start pouring it into the molds, and this guy calls me, and he's going to – Dean, the director. We need to change the design completely. Well, you need to pay me more money because I've got – the day is like literally a week away, and I have to do everything it would normally take me – upwards of 3 weeks. I had to do it in less than a week. So wow. That was cool and challenging. So, I mean, every film is going to be slightly different. You're going to have to do this sculpting phase. Well, first the design phase, the sculpting phase, the molding phase, then you've got the testing, which a lot of times you don't even get that. I mean, there's no testing. And like that commercial shoot that we did, that two weeks for that deer, we had no way to test it. It was like, build it and hope to God it works.
I'm looking at the deer now on the site.
It's pretty awesome.
It's frightening.
Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like I need to go and make sure it's okay, you know?
Even better.
That's super intense. Oh, and there's a Ninja Turtle.
All your stuff is great, Russ. I checked that out too. It's awesome.
Yeah,
awesome,
really cool. I would love to, next time I'm in Ogden, I'll have to give you a call and I'll come out there and check some of this stuff out. I think this would be...
I see with it laying on that blue tarp why people were coming up to you like, hey, man. All right.
Fourth damn deer I've had to make in 12 months. It was like the first one I made was for a movie called Monolith. It was an Italian film that they, I don't know if you had heard about it. They'd shot it in actually Southern Utah. And so they wanted the deer. I made the deer. It's actually going to be flown back to me here in the next few weeks. That was the first one. And then it got out that I was making a deer. Somebody else wanted a deer for their project. And lo and behold, the one with the white face that you guys see, that was the commercial shoot for Colorado. And that was the fourth one in literally a calendar year. I'm so sick of deer.
I bet you never want to see another deer as long as you live.
No more venison. Yeah.
I just noticed, chat room, you're seeing this, but there's a Skeksis in here. Dude.
Yes. I saw the Skeksis. Yeah. It's awesome.
Dude. Put that on the Henson show.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it is fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. I'm freaking out. Well, very good. Don't forget, folks, check out what I've just been looking at. You can see it there at home if you're watching live. If you're at home listening, check out escapeddesignfx.com. That's escaped, E-D, designfx.com, and check out more of Russ's work.
Oh, no, it should just be Escape Design FX.
Oh.
Just Escape. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's not Escaped with an E-D. Hold on. Let me get rid of that.
It's okay. Typo. Damn typos.
Typo. Oh, yeah, there it is. Escape Design FX. You're right. And it's so cool. Like, if... I got to come out there, and I'll let you know, and we'll arrange something, do a little YouTube video or something.
Yeah, right now, it looks like a feature bomb went off in the shop, but, you know.
Hey, whatever. Like, that's what parts that means, work's getting done, right? That's exciting.
They say.
Joel, let's talk briefly about what's going on with your show, the Retro Movie Geek Podcast. Tell us about it. What's going on with that thing?
I would love to. Can I give just a real quick bit of trivia from Aliens, though?
Yeah.
Just real quick, like super quick.
Yeah.
It cost $18.5 million to make that movie in 86. Using the U.S. inflation calculator from usinflationcalculator.com, so I'm hoping it's accurate, that movie in today's dollars would be $40,550,000. Now, think about that in relation to how much most movies that have the scale of Aliens.
Oh, it's it's ridiculously cheap. I wonder what's gone up more. Is it the ability to make the world look right and all
CGI,
the creatures?
CGI, man. We heard it earlier.
I guess so. I guess so, but also, do you think
our actors... are those practical effects guys?
I think our actors and directors are asking for more, too, though. Don't you think? Like, they're probably...
There is that factor, sure.
Yeah. Like, you don't... Back... I mean, I know we had our Tom Cruises of the time or whatever, but they weren't asking for $25 million per movie, so...
Yeah.
I have a feeling
that
might be part of
it. It would probably be less money to get Sigourney Weaver in her underwear now.
You know what? If you want to... I just have a quick recommendation. If you want to see my favorite thing Sigourney Weaver has done in a long time, go see Finding Dory. She has a bit role in that movie that I don't want to give away too much, but she was utterly fantastic in it.
Yes.
So watch for that. Anyway. So Joel, what's going on with your podcast?
Yes, we focus on movies that are at least 20 years or older. I originally did the Forgotten Flicks podcast with my friend Jason, and we did that for a few years, and it's sort of, he had to go his way to a new job, and you know, life happens, and he has like six kids. So you know, things happen, but I have two new hosts now, the Daryl and Peter, and they host Retro Movie Geek. We focus mostly on stuff from the 80s and into the early 90s, occasionally dabble into the 70s and other decades, but lots of tangents, lots of rabbit trails, but you know, that's pretty much the focal point of the show is movies from that era. And every October we do a Spooky Flicks Fest where we just focus on primarily 80s horror stuff. That's usually our wheelhouse. So.
Well, congratulations on your 2010 podcast award for OWN.
Well, yes. Congratulations
to you, Scott. Really? Really, Scott?
Burn. I felt it. That was good. That was a good one.
No, that's terrible. We should do a crossover sometime and have a little host back and forth on Film Sack. But that's
Retro Film awesome. Movie Sack Geek.
That's right. It is retromoviegeek.com. Awesome URL. Yes. Well done on that. So people go check that out. All right. That leads us to what I can only describe as one of my favorite parts of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, you know it as the pop quiz.
America scores and wins.
That music can only mean one thing, and one thing only. It's time for us to test you guys on your areas of expertise, or at least something like it. We are going to start with Russ. Russ, you were given a topic by our mutual friend Hammond Chamberlain that is kind of a hoot. He has said that you need to do 1980s rom-com trivia, and I got the impression before the show that he may have been he may be pulling your leg a little bit. Does that sound right?
I don't know what rom-com is.
romantic comedy.
Okay. I know it's sad.
This is amazing. I cannot wait to see how this goes. All right. So, let's give it a shot and see how you do.
Oh my god.
It's okay if your phone has a problem again during this, Russ. We understand.
Well, right now it's saying I got 14% battery power. Apparently, when it caught on fire the first time, it used it a bit.
Yeah, it just eat up all the battery when it does catch on fire. That's true.
That sounds about right. My cameras are all jacked up, but that's all right. So here goes. I'm going to throw one at you right here. Oh, there we go. I got it fixed now. Okay, so here's your first question. Oh, if you get it right, you hear this. If you get it wrong, you hear this. Tom will keep score, and then you guys will get compared because that's how we roll. Here it is. First question. What song does Lloyd Dobler play while holding a jukebox over his head and Say Anything?
Oh, dang.
I know this.
Oh, my God. Can I have a moment to look up things on the internet?
That would be not in keeping with the spirit of the rules, sadly.
I like the honesty, though. I'm going to give you a half point.
Yeah, half point honesty point. It's pretty good. No one's ever asked us that before. I like that.
I like to try to keep on. I'm going to call it distraction from this stupid phone and its and its needs. There.
I can almost see the answer in your eyes, Russ. Keep thinking.
The light, the heat. Oh, in your eyes.
God. Yeah, it's 90. It's what, 100 degrees here right now?
I'm incomplete, Russ. In your eyes.
They may be giving you some hints. That might be what's happening.
In Your Eyes?
You are correct. Well, nicely done. Well done. It is In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel, specifically the
It
artist.
Is the freaking heat. I'm telling you. Look at my head, man. I mean, it's
just some nuts.
Those hot, bright lights of Current Geek.
It's this damn phone heating up on me. It's like, it's cooking me over.
All right, here's your next one. What position in minor league baseball does Kevin Costner play in Bull Durham?
Son of a bitch. That's not even a romantic. That's just a shit movie. I don't know. Is he a pitcher?
You are incorrect. He's a catcher is the correct answer.
No, but he gets a half point for naming a position in baseball.
Yeah. Well done. Well done. Here's the next one. Nicolas Cage has to shave his chest hair so he would look younger in what film?
All of them?
Hold on a second. Was it the vampire one? Let me think. And I can't even remember. Oh, my God. These are not romantic comedies, man.
I kind of agree. Well,
Was it Arizona, Raising Arizona?
You are incorrect. It was Valley Girl. Valley Girl. Which I guess.
Is that an actual movie? I always thought that was an 80s joke.
I would. These are all so far big favorites of yours. I can tell all these movies we've mentioned. Next question. What character does Julia Roberts play in Mystic Pizza?
What's her name? What do you mean? Her name?
Her character's name.
Damn it.
Do you know where Hammond lives?
No, like, you know, I know he's in Salt Lake and he's about to get a phone call.
Yeah, he's going to get busted big time for this.
Oh, my God. You know, I told him to run these things by me before the show.
Sounds like he was really...
Why can't he ask you, like, what's the first name of the actress who plays Rey in The Force Awakens? You'd know that.
Yeah, you'd know that one, right?
You guys, I never leave the studio, man.
It's a flower.
Yeah, what's your favorite flower? Do you have a favorite flower?
I'm not even going to answer that. That'll get me in trouble. Lily? I was going to say Lily. Is her name Lily?
Close. The answer is...
We're going to give you a half point for naming a flower.
Daisy Arujo. I don't know how you say that name, that last name.
What is her name?
Daisy Arujo. Or it was the name of the character.
Yeah. She works at a pizza place.
At a pizza place. Mystic Pizza.
I didn't see the movie because it was the only movie I found her hot. You know?
There you go. one of the finest revelations here on the podcast. next question. What film features Patrick Dempsey and Amanda Peterson riding off together on a lawnmower?
Oh, that movie.
I get the feeling that maybe these questions should have been meant for Joel.
Yeah. Oh, that movie. That movie drives me crazy.
Oh, my God. Why the hell am I drawing a blank in 100-degree heat?
That's probably why.
I know the movie, man. I just watched it.
Any guess will do.
Oh, my God.
I'll give you a hint. It's it's about buying a thing that has no price.
Man, oh, I love the Beatles.
Okay. Well,
Can't Buy Me.
You are correct. It is Can't Buy Me.
There it is.
Well done. All right, next one. Who played Jack Traynor in Working Girl?
Damn it. Harrison Ford, right?
You are correct. Well done. Well done. Bruce Willis's first lead role was in what rom-com? It's a movie, not the show he was in.
Moonlighting. Hell yeah.
Yeah, well, that's
not it.
That's TV though. So what would you?
Oh, you didn't specify. Yeah. Want the point?
All right, I'm gonna give you a
hint.
No,
he's getting the point.
Is he getting a point either way?
Yeah.
The answer is Blind Date. Blind Date.
Oh, great movie! Damn it.
Yeah.
No, that's
a good movie. I like that movie.
Yeah, it was all right. It was all right. The best part's when he tied plastic explosive to that chair and threw it down the elevator shaft.
That was the best part.
I might be thinking of a different movie.
Kim Basinger was tied to it, I think.
Oh,
I get the
so
feeling
good.
Joel would have gotten every one of these right.
Yeah,
Only
one
I would have missed was Mystic Pizza, because, nah.
All right, we'll see if you knew this one. What Sex and the City star also starred in Mannequin?
Oh, that's easy.
Oh, Kim Cattrall.
Very well done. Nicely done.
Like one of my all-time favorites. Why can't you just ask all Mannequin questions?
That would have been a great trivia.
Next time. Yeah. Next time, we'll make sure they're all Mannequin questions.
Trivia one, or Mannequin one and two. All right,
Joel.
Whatever
you wish for.
Joel, the writing's on the wall, sir. You're going to have to try to do this.
I think I got the wrong category.
Your category is Terry O'Quinn trivia.
Take a shot.
All about the actor Terry O'Quinn. Let's see how you do. Eight questions. First one is, what episode of Star Trek The Next Generation did Terry O'Quinn play Admiral Eric Pressman?
Wow. Yeah. Thanks, Hammond. Last guy got 80s horror.
Question. Yeah. Different. Mike writes the questions. Hammond.
Okay.
He's like the overlord, though.
So okay. I shouldn't blame him.
Give him as much heat as you like. It's fine.
No, blame him all you want.
Yeah, I think I will.
Yeah.
I have no earthly idea. I'm a fan of Star Trek, but not in the religious, I will name episodes for you sense.
Oh, so, well, then just throw a name out. What do you like? Just
Arena.
Let's see if that's right. Nope, it's The Pegasus. The Pegasus.
Yeah, you get a tenth of a point for naming an actual episode.
I know. At least I was in the ballpark. Yeah.
Well done. 30 years earlier, but yes, you're roughly in the ballpark.
Sure.
How tall is Terry O'Quinn?
God. 5'10".
6'2".
Whoa, really?
Yeah, he's a tall guy. So the 2 inches shorter than me is all. Yeah. What does Terry play on Lost, or what character does he play?
John Locke.
Too easy. Jeez, that was an easy one.
Come on, that was a cake, yeah. That was the one I'll get.
How about this one? What state is Terry O'Quinn born in? Where was he born? And it is in the, you know, States United. This isn't a Canadian city.
It's continent. Okay, okay. Yeah. It wasn't like Guam or something.
No, no,
it's
no.
A territory.
Like a state of confusion. Yeah. Or anything. Yes. Yeah. It's not a trick question.
It was like Costa Rica on a layover or something. It was like actual
I want to say Arizona or something out west, but I feel like that may be close, but I'm probably completely and utterly. So I'm guessing.
You are wrong. It is Michigan is the correct answer.
Not even close.
Okay. Michigan.
Although they do call Arizona the Michigan of the Southwest.
They do.
Wow. Next question. What character does Terry O'Quinn play on Falling Skies? I did not know he was on that show.
I didn't either, and I've never watched it. So that works out nice.
Yeah, that works out real good.
He plays John Locke.
Incorrect. Arthur Manchester.
You know, you're getting a half point because he kind of always plays John Locke.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point. Yeah. Third to last question here. Terry played FBI assistant director Kendall in what television series? And I will give you a hint. It is not on any of the three major networks. It was somewhere else. Meaning not NBC, ABC, or CBS. Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, like I said, he was on Hawaii Five-0, right? He was on, trying to think all the shows he's been on recently.
Been on a lot of stuff recently. Man, Hawaii Five-0 sure was a weird catching bag for a bunch of lost people.
They
didn't want to leave the island.
Yeah, BSG and that. And then also Justified was a great place for those people to go.
Yes. Hang on. Yes.
It's weird. Anyway.
Man. I don't know.
It's an A word. I'll give you that. A word. Since we gave some hints to Russ.
A real wife of Beverly Hills.
I got nothing.
The correct answer is not nothing. It is Alias. It is Alias is the correct answer.
Alias.
Yes.
He gets a point for being... honest.
All right. Honesty point. Yeah, I like nothing. It. What universe?
That was, the Alias. Wasn't that with that cross-dresser? It was a drag queen.
Oh, I don't know.
She was the main character, drag queen. No.
Jennifer Garner?
No. Yeah. Oh, Jennifer Garner? She's not a drag queen. She is a lovely woman, formerly married to Batman.
Ask Ben.
She is, yes.
It also stars Greg Grunberg as Weiss. Yeah.
Ah, he
that
is
who now plays Snap Wexley.
Yes.
Yes.
Also not cross-dressing as far as I know. All right, next one. Terry played I already did that one. What university did Terry O'Quinn graduate from?
No stepfather questions, really. Not a one.
Not one. Okay. Not one.
All right. Not even Rocketeer. I'll take a Rocketeer question. Okay. What university?
Yeah. Actual university, accredited
Michigan?
Institution.
University of Michigan?
You are incorrect. The answer is he went to University of Iowa.
I thought you were going to say Arizona. That was going to be...
almost did.
That would have been awesome.
By the way, you said Alias wasn't one on one of the big networks. It was on ABC.
No, it was on Fox or CW or something. No?
Well, you don't consider Fox to be one of the big networks?
No. Well, I mean, okay, I should have clarified. It's not one of the three that existed.
You made it sound like it was a USA Network original.
Yeah, that's what I was searching for. I'm thinking, okay, cable?
We're going to give Joel a half point.
All right, fine. You're not wrong.
Just give me a stepfather question. Just throw me a bomb.
You're not wrong. That's I absolutely screwed that one up. I thought it was like CW or WB or whatever it was at the time. Anyway, here it is. Final question. In what movie did Terry O'Quinn make his acting debut? This does not count made for TV movies. So this is a actual film where he made his acting debut.
Acting debut.
We don't have a date or anything, or I'd help.
I was just say, do you have anything? Give me it. Cause I feel like it would have had to have been early 80s.
Let me check real quick here. It was 1980.
1980.
Okay. So there's your hint.
He didn't pull a Cliff Clavin to show up in Empire Strikes Back, right?
I wish he would have, but no.
Okay. 1980. I'm gonna go through my Rolodex in my head of every movie that came in 1980. I have no idea.
Has Tom been drinking this whole time? Because I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Terry O'Quinn. Is that we're talking about Terry O'Quinn? Yeah. Right? Okay.
Tom's nice and sauced. Pickled Merritt, we call him. The answer is Heaven's Gate, 1988.
Oh, the bomb! Yeah.
That was his first thing that he ever did. Yep, first movie. Well,
according to IMDb.
Well, according to... Oh, you're right. Well, according
Michael Cimino's
Although those are TV, so maybe this is first feature.
Yeah, okay, first feature film. That's part of the criteria. Yeah. It wasn't made for TV.
That was a trick question. Acting debut.
Yeah.
We're giving you a half point.
We'll give you that.
I love that all the points I've gotten are for all the wrong answers. This is great.
all right. Let's see how you guys did. It's always the fun part is to see how you did compared to each other. Tom, how'd they do?
Well, yeah, Joel finished up with 3.6 points, and Russ finished up with 6.5.
Oh, my. Ooh. Look at that.
Holy crap.
Destroyed me.
Well done, dude.
Just like Scott and FilmSack.
Well done.
On the other hand, Joel finished up with 8 points on the rom-com quiz, so I don't know how that worked.
Yeah, that worked out nicely.
That went okay. Well done. You guys were some of the funnest contestants we've had on this silly segment, Definitely. So thank you for that. We got a quick email before we get out of here today. This comes to us from Wing It. Wing It wrote in, says, just catching on Current Geek, listening to episode 96 where you talk about Robot Wars coming back. Spreadsheet just moved. Here we go. You talked a little bit about how it hasn't changed much and mentioned that flying drones would be something new and interesting to watch. It occurs to me that I would be interested in seeing autonomous robot wars where robot behavior is completely controlled by AI software. They would need to be remote activation kill switch to prevent deadly rampages and that sort of thing. I imagine the actual combat wouldn't be all that much different, or would be very different, he says. Would a simpler robot with excellent programming be able to defeat a much more powerful robot with inferior software? Would they be able to develop strategies revolving around confusing other robot sensors? Maybe this wouldn't be as interesting to the general public as it would be to me, but it seems kind of like a natural evolution of the sport, quote unquote, with its autonomous self-driving cars being in the news so much and so on. Wing It, I could not agree with you more, dude. I would love to watch one that is a show that's focused on like a two-team effort. Here at MIT, we're making a robot for this fight, and we got two teams, software team and the AI team, and then we've got our hardware team, and they've got to work together to come up with the best combination of software, AI, and destructive power. And I would be so into that, and I would be glued every week, and I might even resub the cable to get such a thing. So, yes.
Isn't there something real world going on there?
Well, there's actual...
Well, between us and Japan, I guess there's somebody threw down the gauntlet, they're building robots.
Oh, that was the giant machines, that's right.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Plus, there's that show's back on the air that Discovery owns. What's it called? Crap.
Oh, the Robot Wars.
Is it just Robot Wars?
Robot Wars is what we're talking about here.
Okay, you're... that's where I got that. That's where I got... oh, my God.
It's really hot. He's at.
It's like
you need a liquid cooled head right now. That's
gonna have heat
crazy.
Stroke on the show.
It might just be
my freaking phone cold. You know, it's like.
Is it just Bot Wars or something like that? Anyway,
BattleBots.
That's
what it is. Yeah.
So
it is back on, right?
Yeah, there's that. That's a thing that's in its second season of its new thing, and so that's going on. So there's. I mean, this stuff has renewed interest, and the maker.
Here's the thing: AI isn't good enough yet. And even when it gets good enough, the reason they have house robots on Robot Wars is because competitions aren't good enough on their own. You need to spice it up. So I think maybe eventually they do some autonomous battles, but you're always going to have to stage it if you want to make a TV show out of it.
That's a decent point. And you don't think there's any... Yeah, see, that's the problem. That's like reality
what
shows.
Happens when we make smart enough AIs, they go into the ring and they're like, the only winning move is not to play. And then they both just
destroy the humans.
I was programmed to love here's my question, though, Tom. Wouldn't it make sense from some perspective that you would have the maker community come up with? I know they kind of do this anyway with drones and other stuff.
No, exactly. And the reason that you'd have the house bots is when you have real actual bot battles, they're not always dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
They don't always have the tension you need for an exciting TV show. And you can do some of that with editing, but you need to provide that other thing. So yeah, eventually AI might be good enough that you could have it take on the house bots, but I don't think for a show it would ever be pure.
Yeah, you're probably right. TV ruins everything. That's what we've learned today.
TV producers ruin everything.
You sound like
a man says from experience.
Sounds like a guy who knows the truth.
You might have been on a reality show.
You might have. No, that's true. You were. Actually, which was that FX show, wasn't it? No, not FX. The sci-fi show.
Weren't you Sci-fi channel.
Yeah, you were on. That's right. You were on that face-off thing or whatever it is.
No, it was Jim Henson's Creature.
Oh, that's what it was.
It's on line 27 of the doc.
No, my brain, I brain farted because Hammond told me a bunch of stuff and I got it all conflated with somebody else. And anyway, no, that's totally cool. I take it you won and you're now basking in your very popular lifestyle of rich and fame, right?
No, I didn't win, but at least a good guy did, you know, so.
All right, fair enough.
That's good. That's
all right. Well, let's get out of here and send everybody on their way. Big, 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 big thanks to our guests for being here today. You guys were awesome. Before we let you go, though, real quick, just remind people where they can find, Russ, more of your work. What's the website again?
Just escapedesignlettersfx.com.
Awesome, dude. Totally, people should be checking that out. You on Twitter or anything like that where they can follow you?
Yeah, I got a Twitter account. It's also Escape Design. I've got a Facebook account. It's also Escape Design. I did not promote myself at all. I sort of like just whored out the company.
Well, that's all right.
Instagram.
You do what you got to do. It was really great having you on, man. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
Joel, tell us where people can find more of you online.
RetroMovieGeek.com. You can find us there. We have Twitter at RetroMovieGeek. We got a Facebook page. That's pretty much it.
Awesome. Do check it out, everybody. Nothing like a good film podcast. Tom Merritt, anything else, sir?
This week on Cord Killers, we did a How to Cut the Cord special. So you want to go to cordkillers.com to watch or listen to that. And the book, A Brief Guide to Cord Cutting, is up to date now with all the new services and all the new gear. You can find that at tommerrittbooks.com for 99 cents.
That is stupid cheap. That's amazing. Go get that, everybody. What are you waiting for? You know what my method was? Cut it in 2007 and never look back.
Oh, I thought you were going to say scissors. And I'm like, man.
That advice is
complicated.
That advice is free, everybody. Free advice.
Yeah.
Free advice. Nice. Thank you all for hanging out with us tonight. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Of course, you can find more of us at currentgeek.com. All links are there. Our phone number, our email addresses, our Twitter accounts, all of it. So go to currentgeek.com. And find what you need. Leave us reviews wherever you get your podcasts. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and our guests. See you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. Last time, we ran quickly through a summary of many of the significant Supreme Court decisions of this term. This week, we dive deep into arguably the biggest decision of that term, which was Whole Woman's Health v. Cole, also known as the Texas abortion case. This year's Supreme Court term has been notably defined by the absence of Justice Scalia. Indeed, Scalia's absence made the risk for a 4-4 split in the Texas abortion case, which would have upheld the decision of the Fifth Circuit that a recent Texas law restricting abortion clinics was constitutional. That did not occur, as the court split 5-3 along normal ideological lines, with swing vote Justice Kennedy joining the majority, just as he did back in 1992 in the landmark Planned Parenthood v. Casey abortion decision. Ironically, he's the only majority vote from Casey still present at the court today. Under the rules of Roe v. Wade from 1973 and Casey, the standard applied for abortion-restrictive state laws is that if a state law places a substantial obstacle or undue burden in the path of a woman's right to access an abortion, such a law is unconstitutional. This is true even when the law promotes a legitimate state interest such as women's health and safety, which is also required under the constitutional analysis. Turning to the 2013 Texas law, two new requirements were applied. First, that a doctor performing an abortion at a clinic had to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 50 miles of that clinic, and second, that a clinic must meet the same standards as an ambulatory surgery center. Neither of these requirements survived constitutional scrutiny in the majority's decision, written by Justice Breyer. With respect to the admitting privileges requirement, which had already gone into effect, the court found that this did not advance the interest of women's health in any meaningful way. Furthermore, it places an undue burden on access to abortion, based mostly on the number of clinics in Texas being cut roughly in half, from 42 to 19, after this requirement was enacted. With respect to the ambulatory surgery center standards, the court again found that this did not advance the interest in health, but was instead targeted at this one sole procedure, as other more dangerous procedures such as childbirth, colonoscopies, and liposuction were not also subject to the same requirements. If this part of the law had gone into effect, the number of clinics would have been halved again to about 7 or 8. That was sufficient evidence to again let the court conclude that this requirement created an undue burden on the right to choose. With both requirements failing the Casey test, the Texas law was stricken as unconstitutional. The bottom line is, this court continues to strongly protect constitutional rights in a broad manner, with this possibly being the most significant abortion-related decision since Roe and Casey. By applying those prior tests as strongly as was done in the Texas abortion case, the woman's right to choose is on more solid ground than ever, being seemingly safe from any targeted legislative attack from a state. Perhaps this will cause states like Texas to drop the debate over abortion and move on to other social issues of our time. Thanks for listening. If you will be at Gen Con in Indianapolis in August, come check out my seminars on IP law and game design, or message me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy and we can meet up for a drink or a game.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.